This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
The purpose of Righteous Dope Fiend, the central purpose of Righteous Dope Fiend, is to render visible and human a population that's invisible or been invisibilized and that's fled from, or that's avoided and that it is misrecognized and misunderstood. So we also, we don't want to just demonstrate their humanity and bring out their personalities and individualities, but also demonstrate the relations of power that have put them into these positions of what we're calling useless suffering, of politically structured suffering, and trace out in very concrete ways those relationships from their families to the political policies that cut subsidized housing, to the restructuring of the labor force and the labor market, to the forms of gender relations that set up very violent relations between men and women, to the extraordinarily polarized relations between especially African Americans and whites among the homeless. And then the services that are not serving them, the services that are often torturing them, and the services that are working for them. We engaged with trying to bring them into treatment, bring them into the various harm reduction interventions that exist in San Francisco and that exist in Philadelphia. And so that was definitely part of the purpose of the book. And when I began the project in 94, and I was feeling very frustrated because it was just impossible to write about this and have people believe it. I was sitting in my office, in my fancy university office, talking about, you should see the scene. It's just, I went, and got myself a little camera, and I took really crummy pictures. As a matter of fact, Fernando made a movie. Took some of my found footage that I'd thrown out. I didn't want anyone to see. And he made a film that's in that back vault there. And in it, he sort of makes fun of me, not on purpose. It's just that I was in the way. and you see me obsessively trying to flash pictures of this absolutely horrendous shooting gallery scene. And this sort of tragic mixing of needles and in a filthy environment, because this is funded by the National Institutes of Health. It's a straightforward HIV prevention, hepatitis C, prevention project. And I was trying to document that and try to bring it back to the academic and public health community, saying, hey, look, your messages are not reaching. Your messages are out of touch with the realities that these people are living. And I was failing at communicating that. So when Jeff walked into my office, I was on sabbatical, but because I have an overdeveloped sense of social responsibility, I stupidly was holding office hours once a week. Go figure, pathetic, get a life. And luckily I was doing that because Jeff came in, and I was in a desperate moment, and I said, come down with me. And he came down with me. He had his camera. He was asking about doing a special major in anthropology and photography and all these other things, education and who knows what else. And I brought him into the scene and noticed that, first of all, he wasn't bothered by it. It was just in the thick of it. We just walked into one of the encampments where I'd made friends with people. And the next thing I saw, he was flopping all over the ground, taking pictures, not worrying about rolling in the filth and so forth, and telling me, this is really exciting, this is wonderful. And for some reason, they were excited by him, too.
Well, what happened was my background was in community organizing, and I was working with the homeless for about 5 years. So the scene, wasn't...
It wasn't new to you.
Right. But after the first day, I brought 11 by 14 like fine prints to the guys, and they would put them in their camp like we sort of did here, with the duct tape, and that was part of the inspiration of also doing the duct tape, because that's the way it was up in their encampments. And so, but once I did that,
What would happen is they would then, with great pride, introduce Jeff as my photographer. So they all had imagine having a personal photographer who follows you around taking pictures of your every moment. It's actually a wonderful thing. And I was only my professor, which is a little bit less
interesting.
He was the
professor, I was the photographer.
And then we also would occasionally bring in, you know, my doctor. We'd find some real doctors, not fake doctors with PhDs, but doctors that could do something about abscesses. And so they actually enjoyed the project a great deal and would, you know, introduce us to a wider range of people. And also, what would happen is people wouldn't believe them. You know, when they started talking about having this professor and having this photographer and having this doctor who visits them, you know, that, oh, yeah, he's been smoking a lot of crack. And then they would say, you see, this is the doctor. This is my doctor. This is my photographer I've been telling you about. And so, but unfortunately, most of them are dead now. Over half, I think.
A third.
A third have died.
Uh-huh.
And Jeff called one who has a telephone number, who's managed to become housed through
someone he used to panhandle from.
Yeah,
I mean that's how we became.
Oh yeah,
housed.
That's right. Someone he used to panhandle.
Someone he used to panhandle from.
Allows him to sleep in his garage.
Yeah, yeah.
Can I ask you about this? Because you talk about the strange economies of gift giving and hustling and asking you for money. Obviously, they were often asking for a dollar here, a dollar there. But at the same time, it looks like it's a totally parallel economy that has as few links with the normal, let's say, production of social life that we know. I'd like to ask you about.
Oh, absolutely. That. I mean, especially when you if you read the book and you'll see the story of Carter and Tina. I mean, Carter was a professional thief, and his nickname was Woody because he was an expert about stealing wood, and he would go to, this was during the dot-com boom and the housing boom in San Francisco, and so he would steal wood from the different construction sites and then sell it to secondhand or used or, you know, or wood places, but also he would get these beeper, you know, he would get a legitimate contractor would give him a beeper. And would then, you know, call him up and say, okay, I need 22x4s. And so he was absolutely in the mainstream economy. And, you know, this 2x4, the contractor would get 5 cents on the dollar for it. And so it was an amazing, you know, relationship between the legitimate or the legal economy and the underground economy in which they lived, absolutely.
And we saw it with the dot-com boom and bust in the right. sense that when the dot-com was booming, there was wood to be had. The construction boom was extraordinary. And it got to the point where even legal jobs started to trickle down to them because there was such a drawing up of the labor force that homeowners would use them to... the local businessmen would use them to, you know, stack beer into their bodegas and into their warehouses and paint their storefronts and there was just more money floating around, and then all that, of course, dried up very rapidly and wasn't trickling down. They were on the very, very edge of the trickle down.
And for sure, well, Felix was a cab driver.
Yeah, right. One of them even made it to being a cab driver.
He wasn't for very long because he was busted by a neighbor who called to say that they had witnessed him always buying heroin in his cab. And so it didn't work. He didn't last for very long.
Have you had cab drivers who go like that? I don't know. That's happened to me actually quite a bit. They when the red light comes, they go like that.
Yeah.
What do you do?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
What do you do when they do that?
I realize that a dope fiend is driving me, but they always wake up and do fine. But it's an interesting thing actually how you can snap in and out of the nod.
But you analyze, both of you in the book, this culture of addiction, and it seems paradoxical to have a community just gathered by the fact that everybody has decided to be an addict with a sort of rigor from, you know, every day. How did they talk about that? Was it something they were trying to explain to you?
Well, they refer to themselves. I mean, the term righteous dope fiend is a term that they use Dope Fiend especially, mm-hmm. Righteous Dope Fiend, when they're giving it emphasis. It's a term of the older generation of heroin injector, people that are 40 and over. And it's interesting because it's a specifically American term. When I travel and give talks, I try to find a translation for Righteous Dope Fiend. And it really is, it's a subjectivity that's really very tragically American. It's a dedication and celebration of a commitment to subordinating everything in your life to filling your synapses with opiates. And so they've subordinated family, friends, and their own bodies to this very concrete pursuit of heroin. But when you think about it, what we started seeing it is, one, it creates a community of addicted bodies that develops a very deep understanding of itself and of its own needs and of the needs of their fellow members, because they know a tremendous amount about one another's bodies, and there's a certain moral economy of sharing where they're not supposed to leave each other dope sick. They're not supposed to leave each other in withdrawal symptoms. And so they're constantly lending each other small sums of money and small tastes of heroin in order to help one another out when they're in danger of dope sickness. So you see this very intense form of solidarity at the same time that you see them constantly ripping each other off.
Right.
So in the one hand that someone's giving another one a taste, he's reaching into the guy's back pocket to take something out of the other one. And it's a very hard thing. It was very hard at first to understand, and then with time it starts to make sense with you.
It's like in every sort of dysfunctional family, it was in times of crisis, especially when people really, you know, came together. I mean, you've seen the picture. There's a picture, I think it's floating behind me here somewhere, of Hank.
That's Hank. Yeah,
yeah, it's Hank. But Hank, Sonny, and Petey's lying in a coma. Mm. And so, there was a lot of inter-ethnic strife that occurred at Edgewater. But yet in these times of crisis, you know, they definitely, absolutely came together to sort of be a community. And they talked about the way, you know, and they were very proud the way that they could support each other. But then, you know, 5 minutes later, you would just hear some sort of racial slur that emanated from the same person's mouth against that person, especially in regards to owing someone for either money or heroin of some sort.
But the other thing that heroin does is it organizes your life.
Absolutely.
So if you've had a difficult life, if you've had a childhood of trauma, or if you've had relationships that have betrayed you, if you've been thrown out of your job, if you've had crisis in your life, waking up dope sick in the morning, you know exactly what you need to do. You have to. Your priority is not dealing with all the problems in your life. It's dealing with getting heroin in your body. So it's a way to put priorities in your life, to organize it, and to know what you need to do. And there's something, you know, awfully reassuring about that for someone that's being buffeted about and has lost, you know, their keel in some sense. And, you know, the thing that we also saw, though, is these tremendous levels of just physical suffering. Suffering first of all, you know, San Francisco has nice weather, but it's still freezing cold and wet. It doesn't snow, but it's cold in the winter. And they're sitting there shivering with their clothes rotting off of them, with abscesses on their bodies, and hungry.
Hungry.
And yet they've sacrificed all that for this pursuit of heroin. But it's something that was very hard for us to understand. We'd be with them, and they would, you know, we'd be sort of. As, it was especially hard with those that smoked a lot of crack, because crack really uses up your money very, very fast. Heroin, in some sense, if you've got a low habit, you can spend, you can basically maintain yourself, you know, with relatively little money, and on some level, it can tranquilize, you know, an unsteady person. Relatively cheap. It's almost a self-medication with some people. But when they're smoking crack, they're just throwing their lives into disarray, and then the next thing they do is find themselves dope sick and hungry with no money, having spent everything.
And the hunger, I always found the hunger to be especially sort of difficult. And you know, doing participant observation, you would which, you know, by definition, you're a participant and an observer, and you would be, I would be so immersed in their world that it wouldn't be until, because I was able to go home, and I would go home and I'd write my field notes, and then you'd realize, my God, they haven't eaten in 3 days. You know, I mean, they hadn't consumed anything else except for the heroin or the alcohol and whoever you might have smoked crack. And I feel almost like shame because I'd forget that at that moment, that they were actually hungry and suffering. And here in the United States, here were men and women suffering hunger pangs. You know, I mean, they literally had not eaten. And so it was that was really quite challenging, and in retrospect, something I think as I go on to do other field work, I think I'm now, you know, a bit more cognizant of some of these issues that, you know, one would think that we do take for granted.
But isn't it difficult somehow to be an observer in such a situation, or do you think that by writing the book and showing the suffering, you can change some of the conditions? Or do you think, as you said, many of them have died, that there is such a death wish or an economy of waste that there's not much to do?
I think that's, you know, it's something I still struggle with, and especially coming from a sort of a background of activism and of community organizing, you know, wondering if, you know, what the book is going to succeed in doing as opposed to sort of the everyday, meaning, you know, because we're constantly back and forth to the hospital, back and forth to the doctor, on the phone with social services to trying to help them get...
What Jeff is saying, we actually got involved in trying to hook them up with services.
In advocacy work, while doing the field work.
Because what was wonderful was there was no contradiction between ethically engaging with them as human beings in need, who you have to, as a human being, help, try to access what they need, and then observing how that wasn't working, how those services weren't accessible to them. And that was so extraordinarily frustrating, was that, you know, even with us advocating for them, we weren't able to plug them into the services that they need. There isn't such a thing as treatment on demand. The most
totally
mind-boggling thing is the absence of treatment on demand. It's worse, actually, interestingly enough, on the West Coast than on the East Coast. On the East Coast, there's a more massive deployment of methadone, you know, which has its own problems, but at least there's something there, that it's relatively easy to get into methadone. But on the West Coast, there are very, very, very few limited subsidized slots for treatment. And we would, you know, I was chair of a Department of Social Medicine. My best friends at the university were all working with heroin addicts, and they couldn't get my folks in. You had to have a triple diagnosis. Nice. You had to be, you know, HIV positive, schizophrenic, and a heroin addict to get, you know, for the few slots of subsidized long-term treatment.
And they started to get treatment actually because they started to age. And so it wasn't...
So they would be triple diagnosed. They'd have emphysema,
right,
you know, and...
Or they were getting into their 60s and they qualified for Social Security or qualified for, you know, or disability, you know, because of their age. And so that's, you know, how they really started to access services. And so, I mean, it's a shame.
Well, the other thing we did was we found a few miracle doctors that realized that they had to act as the lawyers of their patients.
Their advocates,
so
yeah.
They couldn't just trust the social worker to get the person on Social Security, because that just often doesn't happen. The addict is going to miss their appointments. And so these miracle doctors would actually call up the judges and go those extra 15 steps. And getting on SSI was the... Getting on disability was the thing that would most transform someone, because that's the most amount of money you can get. And it's a stable amount, and they could then parlay that. For example, Hank got housed through his SSI check, which he then pays to rent a space in a garage from one of the people who he used to panhandle from.
And plus, they could get methadone from Medi-Cal, which was, or now, you know, sort of the state-run Medicare system. And they could also access a private doctor. I mean, so they, you know, they, but like I said, it's not because of the suffering that they did every day, it's because they got old.
Can you say just a little bit about race in the way they are regrouping, you describe them moving all the time within a certain encampment. And was that determined by affinities, relationships, or racial identities?
Well, I mean, it was racially, it was fractured. In the beginning, you know, we have a section on one white flight, because literally, you know, these what went on, the whites ended up leaving one camp.
You see, it started out as an all-white scene.
Right.
The initial scene that I contacted and made friends with was all white. And then there was an African-American who was working at the time. He had a legal job. So he was a high-status African-American, and they sought him out because he had money. I mean, he was coming back from payday.
This is Carter.
And so they allowed him to hang out in their scene. And he had grown up. They had all grown up in the same neighborhood above on the hill that they had sort of basically fallen down. They had fallen down the hill into the freeway, and they were living along the sides of the freeway. And they'd been gentrified out of their own neighborhood, which was now becoming a million dollar house value neighborhood. And their families had all had jobs in the industrial sector of San Francisco, which is now where they live, which is now a bunch of abandoned warehouses and abandoned railroad tracks and freeways. And they, the older ones, had managed to have jobs briefly in the steel mills and so forth that all disappeared. Mm-hmm. Their parents primarily had immigrated from the Deep South or from the Midwest, the whites from the Midwest, and from even Pennsylvania, as a matter of fact, and New Jersey, to work in the war industries, in the shipbuilding industry in San Francisco. The African Americans had primarily immigrated from Louisiana, East Texas. And to work in those same Kaiser shipbuilding setups. And all that, of course, disappeared when San Francisco became a high-tech boom city, and there was globalization with all of those jobs disappearing. And so that was the basic structural phenomenon. And you had both of them unemployed, both African Americans and whites, with similar backgrounds in the sense that they were often rural-urban migrations. But the African Americans and whites had had very different integrations into the economy. The African Americans had primarily remained in the industrial labor force, unionized labor force, and on the fringes of the unionized labor force. Whereas the whites, many of the whites, had gone independent from wage labor and had become contractors, had set themselves up. So one's father was a sign painter. Not very good industry to be in. Sign painting is the kind of thing that disappears with time. You know, digital technology gets rid of sign painting. And he had been apprenticed to his father. That's Frank, and there's pictures of him painting. And there's a conversation between Frank and his father just around the corner here that you can listen to.
But his father had been able to, you know, parlay that into becoming also a contractor.
Housing contractor.
And then, but maintaining the sign painting company, and Frank's brother, or half-brother, was able to sell that sign painting company because in the process they had actually bought billboards to, like, Viacom or
something.
And
he was a millionaire.
And now he was a millionaire. And so, and his father had built these houses in these areas of San Francisco that literally are now, you know, a house, you know, his house is probably worth between $5 and $10 million. And so, or Max's father, you know, he was able to become an entrepreneur. Is another one of the white members of the Edgewater Homeless, and he owned a bar.
And what that did was that created a very different subjectivity between the whites and the African Americans. So the African Americans had a memory of well-paid labor, and they rejected being exploited in the menial labor market. They referred to it as slavery, as a loss of dignity, as a loss of masculinity in the case of the men. Whereas the whites had the subjectivity of of the private entrepreneur contractor. It's a very different kind of relationship to, there's no sense of being exploited. There's a sense of just being a failure. You're a failed businessman is a loser. Whereas a fired or laid off union worker is a worker who realizes he's been screwed by the system in some sense. So you had a very different oppositional type of relationship by the African Americans to an awareness of them being mistreated by society or mistreated by their moment in history, whereas the whites had this very depressed relationship to being failures, to not making it, and so even though they were sharing the exact same street corners, often sharing the same drugs and needles and cookers and cottons, they were having a very different experience of those same drugs. The African Americans were claiming to be having fun on their drugs. They were constructing it as being outlaws in an oppositional relationship to a bourgeois society, to an alternative of subordination and slavery. Whereas the whites were actually physically depressed and were, you know, had stopped showering for the most part, were no longer maintaining their clothes, were filling up with abscesses, were not searching for a vein. It's much more fun to shoot your heroin directly into a vein. You get a rush of a high. Whereas the whites had just given up and were just muscling it to stave away the withdrawal symptoms. So they no longer had that ecstasy to the experience of shooting heroin. So you saw this very, very much embodied in how they were presenting themselves to themselves and to the general public. Mm-hmm. Of course, it also worked in terms of their hustling strategies. The whites basically made most of their money by being friendly, harmless winos. They weren't scaring anyone. They could fly a sign like, hey, you know, Merry Christmas, please hire, help me, I'm hungry. And people would feel sorry for them and give them quarters. Whereas the African Americans, when they approached someone, they would generally scare them. Even the oldest and, you know, feeblest and most broken down of the African Americans in our scene would complain that people would roll up their windows, you know, when they approached them on the traffic islands to request quarters.
But they wouldn't do it anyway.
They just wouldn't do it. They would instead provide a service. It would be, I'll wash your car. I'll tell you a joke.
Right.
Are you racist? Give me some money. So it was a very, very different relationship to begging, to providing services, to not accepting subordination. And then the discourse amongst each other was the African Americans criticized the whites for lacking initiative, for just sitting there like losers, expecting everyone to just give them money and not to try to go out and get it, and not taking care of themselves, smelling badly, and just being unmasculine, failing to mobilize violence, and being depressed. That's a loserly thing to be. The whites would hold on to a white supremacy superiority, even though they were clearly subordinated in the street relationship. They would hold on to their racism and accuse the African Americans of being thieves and irresponsible and attracting the police. So you had this very polarized situation that also broke down often. They would often go into alliances and form partnerships and create relationships and even in some cases fall in love.
Yes, that was my another question about love, because in case you'd be negatively impressed, this book has many love stories, or we might say stories of sexuality, but also love was a dominant interaction between those
people.
It's
the narrative we have two narratives that run through. There's the love of Hank and Petey, and then there's the love story of Carter and Tina, and that sort of takes you through the book. And I think, you know, and that love is genuine. I mean, we can analyze that love also in terms of running partnerships and the way they fit within the moral economy. But then that becomes the way, you know, sort of that love is embodied. And but so that love within the scene was absolutely genuine, and was something that was, I think, very important for us to express in the final outcome of the book, because this is also something that we just, you know, sort of the tenderness that did occur, As well as there was the violence within it too. So
I think we want to have to open it a little bit to the audience in case you have questions. I want to remind everybody that basically you need to have the experience of entering these two vaults and listening to the voices and looking at the photographs. But are there questions from the public?
While you think of your questions, there is one thing I want to note, which was completely new for us, and I really thank the Slot Foundation for opening up an experimental space for us to take the risk of working with the audio. I've never presented audio to the public, and it makes me wonder why anthropologists, in a sense, don't do this more often, because audio is incredibly powerful.
You know what, I don't know if anthropologists don't do this more often. I don't know if anthropologists have the spaces.
That's right.
This more often. And so, I really, credit Slot, and I especially credit the Penn Museum for taking these sort of initiatives, and especially in sort of an established place like the Penn Museum, an anthropology and archaeology museum, for taking a topic like this of righteous dope fiend. That's and in a sense, I think there's that risk there, and I think it's important to present these topics in these spaces.
But what I want to ask the audience, when you do listen to the voices, do they work? What kind of an understanding do you get, both of the humanity of the people talking and also of the messages that we're trying to communicate? There's a message about law enforcement that's in there. There's a message about childhood and love and family. That's communicated. There's also just a message about survival strategies, and then there's the message of the storekeepers who are looking at them with disgust. And then there's also messages about trying to access treatment and trying to deal with being sick. And those were the ones that we managed to do. We did the editing with Fernando. For the past month, obsessively. Are there other messages that I'm missing? There's also just messages of the same humanity that we all share, of being nervous about the sound of your voice, of saying, "Oh my God, I sound terrible on your tape recorder."
And they had, right. I felt the same thing when I listened to it too, though. It's like, oh my God.
I don't know enough about Philly yet. I'm doing a project in North Philly with Fernando and George right here. We got an apartment in a tough neighborhood, and they're living there, and I'm just every now and then squatting. But it's actually Philadelphia is obviously a much 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 poorer city. The quality of the drugs are much better, and they're cheaper. And there's also a level of open air markets that I'm just not used to seeing. I mean, Philadelphia is a city that exports drugs. And this is very, my first book was In Search of Respect, Selling Crack in El Barrio in New York. And I lived among crack dealers for 5 years next to a crack house. And there they were basically selling to their own community. In the scene that we're in North Philly, they're selling to people from all over the place who are driving in, who are walking in. There's a very large white population that's young, very young, buying heroin. And there's also powder cocaine, something I'm not used to seeing in street market scenes, with people that are injecting cocaine, which makes you, more frenetic and has much higher HIV risks. It's something that's actually caught me by surprise. I thought I wasn't expecting to see so much distress. I think Philadelphia is a much more distressed city. It's a much more deindustrialized city. We are the poorest of all the large cities in America. We have the highest number of people below the poverty line of any city over 1 million people. And in 2006, we had the highest murder rate of any city over 1 million people. And we have the highest, higher than Detroit, rate of abandoned buildings and abandoned properties of any large city. So we really have some of the worst statistics in the country, some of the most tragic statistics. And I think it makes sense that we would have one of the most robust drug economies, that we would have such a large population that's ready to throw their lives away in investing in selling drugs and going to jail for life. We have a hugely, you know, we basically have these industrial working classes that were thrown out of work since 1940 now for two generations. And, you know, white African-American and Latino, Puerto Rican primarily. And they're really in a very high level of distress. Ironically, with respect to homelessness, the rates of homelessness are much lower here because housing is so cheap and income inequality is not quite as bad. Gentrification, thank God, hasn't taken place and evicted, you know, the working class and the marginal working class. So as a very poor person in Philadelphia, you can rent a room for very cheap. We're renting a two-floor place for $500. But other people are asking to rent rooms. They think we're being extravagant, living only 2.5 people, if you count me as halftime, in such a big space. If we were a normal set of poor people, we'd be then subletting out, you know, another one of the closets to someone else and so forth. So there's less people on the street as a result of that. But there's more people living in intense poverty distress here than I'm used to seeing. And there's more public sector destruction on a level that's, you know, that's just inexcusable. Just acres and acres and acres of burned out buildings, of places where the garbage isn't being picked up, of schools that are leaking, of, you know, schools where the teachers aren't showing up, of schools that admit more children than they can graduate. They don't have enough chairs for the freshman class in the senior class because they know that half of the class is going to drop out. So there's no reason to buy chairs for that many seniors as you admit freshmen. So you have this very structurally, you know, decay of the public sector where we're basically betraying our poor population. And I mean, and that's the tragedy, of course. I mean, Philadelphia is just a caricature of, you know, processes that are occurring less clearly in other parts of the United States. We were a more industrial city than other cities, so we were hit harder by deindustrialization and by globalization and, you know, cheap transport costs from Asia, from China, and so forth. But these are processes that have affected, you know, the entire country.
Thank you, everyone.
So thank you. And thank you, Slott Foundation, again, for giving us this experimental space.